Welcome to the Writer's Lounge Podcast. I'm your host, Tom Riedel. This is a continuation of the Writer's Lounge show, which was broadcast on Blog Talk Radio from 2011 to 2015. After a five-year absence, I'm happy to be back to continue with book reviews and author interviews, where we'll continue to showcase new authors and their books. You can find us on Facebook or over at the personal author page at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net. If you'd like to have your book reviewed and or you'd like to be a guest on our podcast, send an email to writerslounge2020@yahoo.com or contact us over at our Facebook page. You can also find us on several podcast platforms. It's great to be back behind the mic, and I hope you'll enjoy this podcast. Keith Long was born in the suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota. As a pastor and author, Keith pours his creative writing into messages intended to inform, inspire, lighten up, and get people to make some kind of meaning out of their lives. His book, Doubting Faithfully, was intended for just this purpose. There are very few books over the course of the last 9 years while writing these reviews that I have read more than once. This is one of them. I was completely and totally intrigued and captivated by the idea that a pastor of a Christian church would take a plunge into the void of actually questioning the Bible or even the existence of God. Pastor Long steps into the void with a fear but also with an exhilaration, as he did during his youth when he jumped into the river from a six-story bridge. In doing so, it freed him from many of the Christian constraints that he felt bound to through the years. In his example to illustrate his idea of jumping and the fear of falling, he relates to a high-up overhead obstacle course that he once ran and managed during his college years. If you fell off of one of the obstacles, you would be held up by a harness. In relation to being afraid to questioning, even doubting our faith, he encourages us to step outside of your comfort zone. Don't cling to the natural instincts to safety. Fall and test and trust your tether. Long also reminds us that our brains were meant for thinking. Keith Long exercises his views in many ways that I can't even imagine any other pastor or true Christian ever considering. It is an honor to have him on the Writer's Lounge podcast. We'll start a conversation with Pastor Keith Long right now.
Let's do it.
And we're here today with Pastor Keith Long from Minnesota, and we're going to be talking about his book. And Keith, how is Minnesota doing today? What's the weather like there?
It is chilly. It's starting actually to snow a little bit. Some flurries out there, which is actually I'm looking forward to, because it's just winter in Minnesota without the snow is just really meh. So at least the snow makes it look pretty and it gets my kids out of the house to play in it. So great. Yeah, that's how it's feeling.
Yeah, good old Minnesota. Lived there for 20 years and I miss it a lot. Miss the people there, and someday I'll get back there soon. But we'd like to talk to you about your book and some of the experiences you've had in your time during Christianity and then before that, of course. But could you talk to us a little bit about what you explained in your book about your jump into the void?
Yeah, so I kind of liken it to the experience of going bridge jumping, which I've only done once, and that's the one that I talk about in Doubting Faithfully. That experience of all the emotions that go into it, you know, there's the anticipation and the, and kind of the dread and the adrenaline that's going through you, and then there's just that moment of stillness where, you know, what the heck am I doing? And then the jump, and it's all kind of a blur during the actual jump, and of course the landing, and then the really important part, the reflection, and looking back on all of that transpired. And so that's what the actual jump felt like for me. And then, equating it to, looking, reflecting on your beliefs and your core convictions and the way you think about the world through a lens of faith, and choosing to give it up, choosing to just table it and jump away from it and see what happens. And that's what I did over the course of about a 3 year period, really intensely doing that. Of course, always having doubts and being, skeptical throughout, and yet always kind of coming back to faith and feeling good about what I believed. And then there was just that period where I didn't feel good about it, and I needed to think about it differently, and so I did.
Right. And you talk about curbing your curiosity in the name of faith. You mentioned that in your book, and also had said that you wanted to test your tether, and you equated that with your bridge jump, which the actual bridge jump happened during what time of your life?
So the bridge jump happened during my third year of college. I was 20 years old and involved in a pretty strong Christian community in college, and very passionate about my faith at that time. I had questions, and I've always been had a questioning mind, but I was also very, very cemented in my Christian beliefs at that time. Yeah, the curbing the curiosity happened a lot during those years. It was you could ask questions, but to a point, and then it was kind of like people got uncomfortable with the level of question, and so then it would become, well, we won't know everything, so just trust God, and there's no way we can know everything, so kind of, just put your doubts to the side, and believe in spite of your questions, was kind of the way it was phrased.
Right. When you pulled yourself out of the water, did you immediately equate that to your Christian belief, or did it take a period of time before you thought about that?
Well, I remember immediately after wondering how I actually closed my mouth and feeling like that was an act of God, because I remember falling through the air, and it literally just took the wind out of me, and my jaw was completely open as I saw the landscape blurring in front of my eyes, and just that total, the wind was out of me. And then I remember hitting the water, but not having water in my mouth. And so I remember, in the raft after, being like, "How did my mouth close? I don't remember telling myself to close my mouth."
Yeah, but I think a lot of this goes back to what I usually relate to is that God gives you brains and he wants you to use them. And sometimes he wants us to maybe not in a biblical sense, in a biblical term, but he wants us to think outside the box a little bit. I really truly believe that. And that leads us into, your story here. And it's the talk of belief, the idea of belief. What is it to believe? I know in the book you had talked about having a conversation with a woman who had said that she believed that her daughter didn't believe, or that her daughter was taken from her because what God wanted her there, or how does that fit in?
Yeah, so I in my during my internship year, which in our my denomination is your third year of seminary, so you go to class for 2 years and then you do a year in the field, so to speak. And I was an intern pastor, and I would do visits and pretty much everything a pastor would do, but I had a supervisor. So anyway, during that year, I was on a visit with a very elderly woman, and Minnesota elderly love to take care of their pastors, and so there's almost always cookies and you know, it's just a time to get together with little treats and conversation. And so we were together for conversation, and I was just getting to know her. And she shared, I don't know how it came up, but she shared that she lost a child. And of course, this is always really devastating to hear as a pastor or a friend. And then she started to describe how she got through the experience and mentioned that her rationale was that God needed her child more than she did. And of course, this just was really appalling to me as a young seminarian and lifelong Christian. And I've developed these beliefs that couldn't be the case. There's just no way that could be the case. And I'm kind of, you know, developing my counter argument to this in a way to do it in a way that's pastoral. And she stopped me before I even got there and said, "Nope, before you try to talk me out of it, this is what I need to believe to get out of bed in the morning." And, and that just stopped me in my tracks, you know? And I just was like, okay, that's what you need to say. Then who am I to tell you anything different?
There's an old saying which you mentioned in your book that I've come across quite a bit too in my studies and sometimes conversations with other people, that there's no atheists in foxholes. Can you reflect on that?
Yeah. So I would hear that pretty frequently, and you'd hear it's mostly said by other Christians, and with that, the idea that, you know, when push comes to shove, when it's a really, really frightening, dangerous time, people who say that they're an atheist, or people who say, you know, that they're going to call out, they're going to cry for God for help, that in those dire times, they're going to break with their non-belief, and they're going to ask for help. And I believe that, you know, I believe that completely, until I met somebody and had a really close friendship with somebody who didn't. I had a really close friend from high school and beyond, Carl, and very intelligent, articulate, funny guy, and he came down with ALS. And I mean, if you're familiar with ALS, with Lou Gehrig's disease, it's just devastating. Your mind stays intact, but your body breaks down slowly for some and very quickly for others. His was about an 18 month battle. I was with him right at the end. I knew that he identified as agnostic, as, you know, atheist. He was, you know, we could talk about anything, as I hope, you know, you're able to do with your close friends. And he knew I was a pastor, and if there was anybody that he could have confessed to and called out for help at the end, it would have been his pastor friend. And he didn't. He held true and defied the foxhole theory just perfect, you know, like he didn't break, I guess you could say. And that really shook me, because I thought he would. I thought, surely this guy with ALS, leaving behind a wife and two kids, you know, I thought for sure he would say, you know what, let's give this God thing another look. And he didn't. He went into the unknown of death completely without belief.
Yeah, and that not only, you know, shook you, but it also was the beginning of your transformation, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. After that, I mean, it was obviously the grief was so intense, losing a friend at 39 years old like that. And yeah, I know we had talked prior to his death. I had asked him, you know, what do you think happens when you die, and where do you think, you know, you go? And I, you know, I went through all of that, and, you know, he had good responses, but again, they weren't Christian responses that I was familiar with. And so, like, yeah, when he died, then it was, I need to rethink this, because up to that point, the Christian belief was, if you didn't believe in Jesus, you weren't going to experience a positive afterlife. And I just at that moment, I refused to believe that that was true. I had already kind of been questioning that, but that cemented it for me where I said, nope, you know, there's no way that a loving God would condemn someone like Carl for eternity because he didn't believe the things that you're supposed to believe, at least, again, what I had thought up to that point. And so then once I kind of refused that, then that led me down this rabbit hole of I want to think how Carl thought and at least look at things from that non-belief perspective. And what does that feel like? You know, what does that feel like to abandon kind of those beliefs and just turn the apple cart upside down? You know, what would happen to me if I did that? And how would I feel and how would I interact in the world?
Right. Did Carl ever argue with you over your Christian beliefs? Did you have arguments, heated arguments over the existence of God, for instance, in your earlier years?
No. In my earlier years, when we were really close, I wasn't as passionate as I was. But, you know, I definitely believe in God and had been, I had attended church and had those beliefs. And we would talk about those things when we were younger, but not to the extent, I think, until we were older. And I, you know, I was a pastor and we kind of reconnected as adults. And no, he was just a great conversationalist and always, again, very, very intelligent. And yet he didn't lord that over you. But some of the points he would bring up and, you know, one of those things you hear and you're like, oh yeah, that's actually a really interesting perspective or point. And you'd still kind of defend yourself a little, but it was never heated or, you know, to the point where we were shouting or anything. It was always like, well, consider this. No, well, you consider this, or what do you think about this? And it was very, very cordial.
Right. The word atheist conjures up a lot of different feelings for different people, especially a Christian, when they hear that word. To immerse yourself into that kind of environment, being with an atheist, and I've been around a couple of them, and they're more godly than anyone that I ever met that went to church, some of them.
So, yeah, that's exactly it.
Right. Right. And
if you're judging someone based on what they say, I mean, how are you basing someone's standing with God? Are you basing it on what they think or are you basing it on how they act? And I think that's where it came for me with Carl was if I just take based on how he acted and how he interacted with his kids or with, you know, he was a teacher, so how does he interact with his students? How does he interact with his friends and in his family? I mean, like he was straight A, you know, like he was compassionate and loving, forgiving, which I mentioned in the book. The lessons that he taught just through his actions, again, people who wouldn't have any idea what his belief system were, if those people were Christian, they'd say, oh, he's for sure a Christian.
Sure.
You know, but he wasn't. And again, do we really want to believe in a God who would condemn someone like that because of they didn't believe the party line, so to speak?
Have you ever had deep conversations with other Christians like yourself about atheists and their thoughts on that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Many times. Many times.
Down, like they're evil, demonic, or are they just regular people that just don't know any better?
I mean, the term that most Christians have for atheist is lost. That they are lost. They kind of like what you just said. They don't know any better, and they've fallen away. Or of course, I mean, there are different just like there are different types of Christians, there's different types of atheists. I mean, there are some very aggressive, militant atheists who are very, adamant and abrasive with others, just the same as there are Christians that are like that as well. And then there's Christians who are not like that. But I think for the most part, the Christians I've talked with, when the topic of atheism has come up, if they knew somebody who was atheist that they loved, of course, that would change things a little bit too. But if they didn't know anybody personally, it was always like, oh, well, they're lost and they don't know any better. And I don't know how they live their life without God. What do atheists do when tragedy strikes? How are they able to get through this without the power of God? I mean, those kinds of things would constantly be said. And then I, again, I would probably join in with them before all this happened. And now after that, I always find myself defending them and being like, well, you'd be surprised. They can get through it just fine. They've got great support system. And
sometimes I wonder if God isn't working through them to teach us a lesson.
You're right.
And
yeah.
In your book, you had a nice quote here about going to church. And you had said, all that love I kept hearing from their mouths felt absent in their actions.
Mm-hmm.
In regard to, I believe, what you were referring to as churchgoers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When you're surround yourself, it depends on where you're surrounding yourself. And I'm sure if you're hanging out, it depends on where you're hanging out and who you're with. And of course, there's all sorts of reasons why someone could be doing something based on what's happening in their life at the time. But it was, you hear all this talk, but then when you're interacting with them and you don't feel that same level of respect or kindness or love, and yet, when they're with a group of people and they're saying other things, and then again, you get them on their own, and it's like, you're a jerk, or
right,
like,
right.
How can you act this way when you just said a couple, moments ago, how much God loves you and how loving God is, and you should be acting like that, and you're not. And right. it became that very hypocritical. Whereas an atheist, when they don't have that sense of, like their actions are being guided moralistically because of their, their beliefs, you can't hold them to that standard. And so then, yeah, it feels pretty authentic when they are acting in kindness, and then your only logical response is they're doing that because that's who they are, not because they feel like they have to do that or they're under obligation to do that. That's authentically who they are.
Right.
And you can't always say the same thing for the way, someone with Christian or otherwise, it's sometimes a little harder to see that's actually who they are.
Right. And talk about jump. You had mentioned in regards to that you took a pretty good jump. And in the book, I was like holding my breath when you said you were going to give up God for Lent. and so I would like you to explain why you did that and your experiences from doing that. Probably
so,
done a lot of what we just talked about, but it was a pretty dramatic.
Yeah, this was a structured thing. The author and theologian Peter Rawlins, I had discovered him through his book Insurrection, and I think I had learned about him through Rob Bell. And just started reading some Peter Rawlins, and then discovered that Rawlins led every year on Facebook in a group, and he paid for this. He called it Atheism for Lent, and it was a guided instruction and discussion with others who'd signed up for it into various systems of belief or non-belief and philosophy and, again, atheistic thought. And it was this program. I mean, it was like, you know, 6 weeks. And each week he would share a reflection and a teaching, and we would get these readings to do, and then we would discuss them with one another. And so I just love intellectual stimulation, and I can't get enough of it. And there's only so much pastoral continuing ed you do where it eventually kind of just feels like it's being recycled and repackaged. And I thought, you know, this is right up where I'm at right now. I want to learn what it means, where they're coming from, you know, what are some of these systems of thought that I guess are the antithesis of Christianity, that are, you know, again, so evil and so wrong. I wanted to just jump into it myself and learn for myself. And it was fascinating, I'm telling you.
So you
it was
directly into the foxhole with the atheists.
Yeah, yes, yes. And other spiritual nomads like me, people who were curious and, again, more daring to put themselves in a place where, I mean, you don't go into this without having a very secure faith. I mean, this isn't, I don't think my general, I guess, thinking of who was here was people that were either really secure in their faith, pastors and the like, or people who didn't have any beliefs and kind of just wanted to be affirmed in that. And then these two kind of came together, you know, people that are just really open-minded and curious, but, you know, pretty secure in what they think. And then the people, again, who maybe are outside a Christian or a traditional sense of faith, but also deep thinkers, critical thinkers. And so all these critical thinkers get together with all these different backstories, and they get immersed in, you know, Greek philosophers and, you know, again, some pretty strong-minded atheists and others that just, you kind of just throws a question out there that makes you stop and think. And yeah, and I did. I gave up God. I gave up traditional belief in God during that Lent, in the sense of, I'm not going to go into this trying to defend God. I'm going to go into this with a blank slate and let these words hit me and then wrestle with them and try to come up with an interpretation of how this either works or doesn't work for my own personal theology, I guess.
It's an incredible journey into the fire for a pastor to take, I would think, to do that. But it's not so much unlike Jesus did when he went into the desert. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Pastor, but when Jesus went into the desert, didn't he meet the devil?
Yeah, so the tale, the parable goes that he goes into the desert and he fasts for 40 days and 40 nights. He's without, you know, he's again fasting without food, water. And at day 40, the devil appears and begins to tempt him and test him. And so, I mean, the idea is, okay, you're at your weakest moment in the fact that your body is broken down. You want is a warm, you know, meal. You want to get out of those conditions. And now you're being tested, you know, are you going to give in or are you going to hold to your convictions? And so that's kind of the way the story unfolds. And so similarly, I mean, I was kind of in this, wasn't quite broken down to that extent, but I was, you know, questioning significantly more than I ever had. I was at that point where I'm like, I don't know what to believe anymore, and kind of exasperated and throwing my hands up. So I was entering into the fire in the sense where I wasn't as secure as I used to be. I wasn't completely all gone. I was in this melting pot of belief and thought and abandoning certain things and looking anew at other ways of thought about God and the world. And so, yeah, I was definitely right in that point. It was very influential and just fascinating. Like I said, some of the stuff I never heard of, you know, never heard of some of these arguments. And it was really, really It was a great experience. And I met some other just fabulous people who I never felt judged by. There was, you know, in many ways, I felt closer to that crowd than I had to the church-going crowd, where it felt like there was so much fear present whenever you talked about doubt. People didn't want to, they didn't want to stand out in that way. Whereas with this other crowd, it was like, that was the name of the game. Everyone was there because they had doubts.
Right. And those must have been character changing moments for you to be out there in that environment. And then now coming back closer to the Christian beliefs, especially during these times, which in just a couple of weeks, I believe we've got Christmas here. And let's talk about Jesus's birth. That was another segment of your book that had me cringing a little bit. I was wondering what this pastor of faith, what this Christian would be saying about Jesus. And I wanted him to reaffirm my belief that Jesus is the Son of God. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so that's interesting how you bring that up, because, you know, the idea of cringing, of, okay, you know, what is going to be said here? Is this going to, how am I going to have to think about this? And I think that's really, you know, when you stop and think how most Christians come at some of these topics, it's, I want to be affirmed in what I already believe, is kind of the status quo. You know, I don't want to have to be stretched here, because these are my core convictions. So I really hope that this leader is going to, you know, pat me on the back and tell me good job, right? You're on the right track. And it's really difficult, has been difficult for me as I've studied these texts and gotten a chance to know a little bit more of the backstory and the cultural, historical, you know, context of the time, and to know, okay, hold on a second. You know, did this really happen exactly as it's written? And it, you know, to dig, because, you know, we're basically paid to dig into this, yeah, and to find, you know, some kind of thing that we can relate it to our daily lives right now. And this is, you know, okay, make it relevant, pastor. Make it something that, you know, resonates with me. So the more I would dig, the more, you know, you look at, you know, some people maybe only think there's one Christmas story. They've only ever heard the Gospel of Luke. And so they think, well, that's the story. But if they look at Mark, they look at John, they look at Matthew, they're going to get a different story. And so Christmas started to feel kind of like it was a setup to me. And I wanted to know how much of this is true and how much of this isn't. It, you know, in a sense, it was kind of like you get a bunch of kids and you interrogate them individually, right? You separate them out and you say, okay, tell me about Jesus. And then they're each trying to make Jesus, their friend, look really great. But they didn't collaborate their story before they got separated into those rooms. And so you're gonna get all these different explanations and descriptions for Jesus, and they're all great, but they're all different.
Right.
And that, again, wasn't so much of a problem until it became problematic. And then it was, okay, I don't know who to believe here. And does it, and then, it, you know, then it, the more I unraveled the onion, the more it was kind of like, well, does it matter which thing is true and which thing isn't? And that's where kind of that mythology started to come in, where it became, okay, maybe not all of this is true, but what is the meaning that they were trying to convey?
Right.
And so that's kind of where I ended up.
I guess my question about that would be a general question to you and all Christians and myself, would be the virgin birth. If we don't believe in immaculate conception, can we still believe Jesus is the Son of God and have a path to heaven? That's the question.
Well, that's your question.
Yeah, that's the question I think that a lot of people would be thinking, and I still believe he is. But we talked a little bit about this off the air, about what did it mean? What did the Bible mean when they talked about the Son of God? But aren't we all sons and daughters of God?
See, I think that's the rub right there is, what do we mean, or what do we think the Bible means by this? And then fill in the blank. And, you know, up until just a couple of hundred years ago, many didn't need to take the Bible literally in order to find value in it. It was only kind of in that period of enlightenment where the church became under fire, where there was kind of this clamp down to say, you know, if you question this, then that makes you outside the church, kind of thing. And so there was just kind of this overcorrection, if you will, where people became, you know, really feeling like they're under attack if someone was questioning their beliefs. And so I don't think that we have ever fully understood the significance of this virgin birth story. I think it's a very misunderstood concept in our modern day era. There's plenty of scholarship out there that, you know, when you look at how the Bible was interpreted, it wasn't always virgin. It used to be interpreted as young woman, and virgin is, you know, kind of thrown in there, but it was never like 100% consensus that this is of a virgin, but it was very important to the church because Jesus became extremely important to the church. And so the way I talk about it in the book is, how do you, you know, there's Greek mythology with virgin births. There's all sorts of myths that purport, you know, these characters that they really wanted to make sure that stood apart and said, okay, well, but you got to look at their upbringing, their origin story. Origin story is really, really important to anybody who's considered anybody. And Jesus was no different, you know, and when they started to go backwards and say, oh, we got to make sure that people understand how important Jesus is, you know, the crafting a great origin story was part of that.
Yep. And then, so we go from Jesus's birth to Jesus's death, which would be Easter. And you had mentioned in your book, how can anyone have made out any words from someone hanging from a cross while dying from asphyxiation? So that's another great question that we all have to think about and wonder about and try to get through.
Yeah, because you know, it just, for me, it's I come from a kind of a filmmaking visual learner background, and so I'm constantly, you know, listening to these and reading these stories from a standpoint of, well, how did they get this information? You know, today, with such a journalistic world we live in, microphones right in people's faces, getting every single soundbite possible that they can use for a print article or a soundbite, that kind of thing. I mean, that in today's world, if something like this happened, you very well could have a microphone right there, could catch every single word that was said. But we're not talking about that 2,000 years ago, you know,
right?
You know, he was on a cross, separated on the city limits. You got a couple of other criminals next to him. You've got Roman guards patrolling the place. Like, nobody's there with a notebook, listening in and writing these things down. So it just became that question of, like, how is he able to talk so much when he's suffocating to death up there? And two, to be saying, you know, these really powerful things that theatrically sound wonderful, you know, and horrible, I mean, all at the same time. But then it just kind of goes back to, did that actually happen? Because in this other book, he only says this. And in this other one, we don't even have anything. You know what I mean? So I think about this stuff all the time. I don't know if, I mean, I wrote this book because it's like, I just needed to get it off my brain because I'm just constantly thinking about it. and right. wondering what is true and what isn't true, and what does the Bible mean when it says this, and how are we supposed to actually interpret this for our lives today? So, I mean, a virgin birth, okay, I'm able to step away and say, they really wanted to make sure that Jesus was really important. And so here's this story. And when Jesus died, we need to make sure that that special aspect and attributes of Jesus doesn't get lost either. So we got to make sure that there's a really powerful death narrative going on and, you know, sold, you know, Jesus was awesome. And I'm not denying that at all. And I'm not saying, no, you know, he wasn't anything. No, I'm the opposite. Jesus was awesome. It's a matter of what am I supposed to get out of this story of Jesus that can speak to my intellectual integrity today without having to, like I said, kick that to the curb and just believe blindly without asking right. questions.
Right. I think as I opened up with, we were talking about thinking outside the box. And sometimes I think the Bible puts us in a box. And Apostle Paul had said that we should be pitied if we don't believe Jesus was raised from the dead. I think that puts you in a box and doesn't allow you room to think anything else. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would say, you know, that okay, the line in the sand has been drawn. You can question, but only up to this point before you need to then check yourself. And that, it's a threat. I mean, it really, what it is a threat that says, if you now don't believe this, then yeah, what's wrong with you? Then you can't belong if you don't follow these, you know, these beliefs, these rules. So yeah, it had served as a pretty constricting box for many years. But when you start to question one thing, you start to question a lot of things. And then it, you know, and I'd always get to that point. And I'd be like, okay, I'm out. I don't want to be, you know, kicked out or fired, or, you know, I'm not going to push that envelope. But then I, you know, started to think differently, like, well, but what did Paul mean? And do we know exactly what Paul thought, and who was he talking to? And all those questions then came into play, where I was a lot more open-minded to say, well, let's rethink this a little bit. Maybe it's not exactly as it appears.
Right, right. We talked about Jesus' spirit coming back, and in off the air, we talked about paranormal experiences, which I am a paranormal investigator, and have my own unique stories to tell about it. But you also encountered something that sort of changed your view and maybe bent you back the other way to think maybe there is life after death and all of this is true. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you can think all you want, but your experiences always trump your thoughts. Yeah. You know, yeah. when you encounter it, it's you have to then rethink. And I had been in my head for so long thinking and wrestling and peeling back and digging deeper and formulating and articulating, and I'd been doing that, and then I had an encounter that made me completely do a double take on everything.
That was your trip to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Yes, yes. So had been wanting to go to Gettysburg for so many years, especially when I was living in Richmond and became really passionate about the Civil War and Civil War history, and always I love a good ghost story, especially from people that I know, and just would always love to hear what their story was. And, you know, I mean, just getting the goosebumps and, you know, all that kind of, that's just like, it's a visceral way of hearing a story. And so I'd always was just fascinated, but I'd never had anything happen to myself. And so I had a chance to be out in Gettysburg. And so I was going to make the most of it. And I went on ghost tours and listened to the, you know, the stories from the locals. And I was staying at Well, pretty much everything. Gettysburg became a hospital, and so I was at the seminary campus there, which is where the war first or the battle first broke out, and then became a hospital. And we each had individual rooms and without roommates in the the dorms, I guess. And yeah, middle of the night, I'd gotten back from a ghost tour that I went on by myself and with a group of other locals, and had started to just really have some experiences. Look, either through sight and just hearing this, just you're getting the willies, right? You're starting to freak out a little bit. Like, okay, this town is definitely, there's something going on. There's an energy here, and I don't know what it is, but just kind of having those gut feelings. And went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night and still can't explain it to this day. I don't know if I made it all up. I don't know, but it was a smell and not a sight. And a pretty good nose and knew it was pipe tobacco. And yeah, the rest is, you'll have to read the book, I
Right.
guess.
So we're not going to go too much into it. We'll leave that out there for the readers to check in to. But I would just end that segment by saying that we're usually questioned about what we see, but we're not usually questioned about what we smell.
Right.
So a lot of ways that sense is stronger than our sight when we tell a story, because not too many people can make up a smell, or you can try to debunk a smell, but sometimes you just can't come to a conclusion.
Yeah,
And
it's
when you
very personal. I mean,
conclusion,
your sense of smell is very personal. I think we can agree that you can fool the eye pretty well, but smell, which it's just so personal, and it's really hard to talk yourself out of that smell because it is affecting that probably your strongest sense in your body. And I'll just never forget it. And like you said, it was a turning point. I just started to go, wait a second, if that happened, then what does that mean?
right. Okay, so let's talk about prayer. I come to you, you're my pastor, I'm in a congregation there in your church, and I have an aunt that's dying from cancer, and I need prayer. So now tell me, Pastor, how does that work, and what is prayer in your belief system now?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I don't know how prayer works. I don't know where that prayer, who hears that prayer. It's totally in that mystery folder of I don't know. I don't know how prayer fits, if it does. It's just all those things. It's a huge question mark for me. But the more I studied prayer and meditation and mindfulness, and I found how useful and helpful it is for a human being to pray, to quiet the mind, to focus on something that's bigger than yourself, that's outside of yourself, to keep people in your thoughts. It does something to the way that you carry yourself in the world and how you talk about people, how you talk with people. And so prayer is still a practice that I do, that I continue to highly value as a leader and as just an individual. And somebody comes to me with something troubling them, I have no qualms about praying and handing that over to the mysterious spirit, Holy Spirit, to God, creator, source, higher being, whatever they're comfortable in referring to, something that's bigger and outside of themselves. I prefer spirit creator, source of all, something along those lines. And yeah, trying to get the person to release it to you know, I mean, it's therapeutic. It feels really good to get something, you know, off your chest, to get it, you know, to just speak it, you know, away, to make sure you're naming it. You know, it's just kind of a way to take away the power of it, is to name it. And so I think prayer is really important and something that I'm not going to be letting go anytime soon. But if I had to sit there and tell you how it works, and I couldn't, I mean, I have no idea. I don't know why some people's prayers seemingly are heard and some people's prayers are ignored. I mean, I don't understand.
Right. And I think that kind of goes hand in hand with what we talked about earlier about spirits and your experiences at Gettysburg. It's very possible that even though you may doubt, well, I'm doubting Thomas, but even though you may doubt something, doesn't make it so.
Mm-hmm.
Always have to leave open the possibility that what we may be thinking, as far as, you know, Christmas and Easter and all the activities that Jesus went through, may have indeed happened, but maybe not in exactly the way the Bible says it did. But we have to leave open the possibility that it's real. Am I right? Do you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the world would be a better place if we all could say, I could be wrong more often than we do, you know,
right.
to let go of our need to be right and to be certain about something, to just say, you know, I could be wrong. This, you know, like you said, just because you doubt doesn't mean it didn't happen. Just because you believe didn't mean it did. And, you know, and just go in with an open mind and a willingness to explore and to question, to hear somebody else's perspective, to just own that you don't have all the answers.
Right. And there are stories out there of prayer, remarkable stories that we just can't discount, that would point to a real God and a real Jesus. I have a few of my own that I've heard over the years, and I've been involved in prayer myself, and it has benefited me greatly in my life, and my belief in God is strong. Whoever or whatever God is, I believe in it. Final part here, Pastor Keith, would be to talk about your response from your congregation. I'd like to know what people are saying about you now that the book is out, and how has that been going?
Well, it's been very positive, Tom. I was surprised. I was pretty nervous about it when I was writing the book, and anxious that it was not going to be received well, that people were going to distance themselves, they weren't going to trust me anymore. I was really nervous about it, and I just, you know, kind of sweating about it, and it has not been that. I've been very pleasantly surprised. People have been very, very welcoming of my honesty, grateful. They've shared questions of their own and asked, you know, for some insight, or to just say, hey, this was my question, you know, thanks for sharing yours, and here are mine. So I think there's hope. There's a lot of hope for the church, not just this church that I'm currently serving at, but for, you know, all the church, in the sense of the response has been a lot more affirming than I anticipated. Now, that said, it's been minimal. I mean, not a lot of people, I don't think, have read it yet. And I've heard a few people that have had concerns. Those with a lot more orthodox beliefs have, you know, were not as receptive and were concerned for me. And so there's been, you know, a little bit of the other side of things. But generally speaking, I think the honesty and the fact that this is, you know, kind of my personal truth, that's been it's been really warmly received, and people have appreciated that and resonated with it. And so I'm optimistic that it'll be more positive than negative. Although I know whenever you throw truth down, I think, I don't know, was it you that shared the quote with me? First, it pisses you off, before it resonates, you know, and I think that's true. It might stop a couple people in their tracks, but generally speaking, this congregation hasn't been that surprised given the fact that I've been preaching this way. I've been teaching this way. My conversations, they, you know, have been full of questions and doubts. And so it's not like they were blindsided by any means.
Right. I really want to thank you for being on the show today. We've talked a lot about what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be an atheist. And we are right now in the midst of a Christmas time. And I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas. And I also would like you, before you go, to tell everybody out there where they can find you on the web.
Yeah, well, thank you, Tom. I love to talk about this subject. And of course, it was a labor of love and getting it in written form and a spiritual purge. So thanks for having me on the show. I'm kind of in a lot of different places, passionate about podcasting. I have a podcast on Anchor here called the Pastor Faster 5-Minute Podcast. I also do that in a video form through our YouTube channel at church and our church website. I have a blog there at stlukecg.org. Have a couple of other blogs. Twitter, at Skeptical Pastor is my tag. Those right. are kind of the big ones. So, and of course, the book is on Amazon and Kindle. And so check that out there as well.
Okay. Pastor Keith Long wrote the book Doubting Faithfully, and I would encourage you to go out there and read it. It's an absolutely wonderful read. I read it twice. So I hope you all do the same. And Merry Christmas to you again. And take care of Minnesota for me.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Okay, Keith. Take care.
That's it for the Writer's Lounge podcast for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I would encourage you to share our podcast with others, whether they be inspiring writers or voracious readers. There is something here for everyone. If you are one of those inspiring writers and you've just become an author, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a message on Facebook and we'll get back to you. Until next time, happy reading, and if you've got a pencil or keyboard nearby, don't hesitate. Sit down and let the story begin. See you next time on the Writer's Lounge.